This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com. Good morning, everyone. It is Sunday, November 17th, 2013. Beginning a brand new class series, something that I've never done before in the shul, going through the laws of Shabbat. One of the reasons why I never gave this before was I had no idea how to give a class like this where each class can really be standalone, which is something I tried doing before because people didn't show up to class regularly. This will definitely make a lot more sense if you come on a regular basis. We'll see how much people can follow without it, and we'll repeat as necessary. For our text, we will be doing Rambam, Maimonides, and I want to spend some time explaining why we're going to be doing Rambam as opposed to anything else. Because even though in the halachic process series I explained, you know, why I like Rambam's halachic methodology better than others, from a practical level, people don't actually follow a lot of what Rambam says. Some things yes, some things no. But when you get right down to it, when you get to the nitty-gritty of Jewish law, someone tells you this is Jewish law, or this is practically how you handle something, odds are someone's going to disagree. And by someone, I don't just mean like find, you know, wacky person in another denomination. I mean someone within traditional Orthodox Judaism is going to have a difference of opinion. The problem, though, is there's a bit of, as we explained in the halakhic process class, when you get to that nitty-gritty, people are playing with different methodologies, not all of which are going to make sense. And over time, I've learned to distrust pretty much any halacha book. I brought in one just to give an example. This is one volume out of four in a series called The 39 Malachos, published by Feldheim, authored by Rabbi David Ribiat. So you got four volumes about yay size. It comes in a nice boxed set. Runs a little more than $100 these days. This was given to me as a gift. And you could tell this is incredibly comprehensive. A lot of details written in various outline format. Red flag one, like many books I tell people, is you always look at the footnotes. And because when you have a compilation of halacha a book that's a compilation of Jewish law, the footnotes tell you just where they're getting stuff from. And when you follow the footnotes, you see they're quoting a lot of different people. Then you have to ask, well, why are you quoting this person here and that person there? Right? Are you being somewhat consistent with it, or how did you make these decisions? The other thing here is you'll notice that the footnotes in this book are in Hebrew, where the body is in English. My guess it's because the author would probably, and this is speculation, but I think it's warranted, if you don't know enough to follow the footnotes, you probably don't know enough to question the sources. Right. However, I want to read just a few passages that I found particularly troubling to illustrate an example of why you don't trust these books. All right. So first is, this is all from volume 4, page 1079. We don't have to worry about the details of these particular laws, but about the difficulty of having the approach to Jewish law. So this is a discussion on page 1079 on the use of umbrellas. It says here, umbrellas may not be held aloft on Shabbos or Yom Tov, even if previously left unopened, and even if where there is an Eruv, because an umbrella is considered a halachic canopy, since it protects the area beneath it from rain or sun. Although an analogy between the use of an umbrella to that of an attached awning, which is permissible. In the previous notes here, he explains why if you have like an awning, that's fine to open and close on Shabbat. Is not without basis, the preeminent poskim of earlier generations nevertheless saw it fit to extend the prohibition of ohel, creating a tent, to umbrellas. One dare not trifle with this restriction. Basically, if this was like a small book, like 200 pages, that was giving a quick summary, I might be able to buy that. When you're giving a detailed explanation about how things work and why, you're acknowledging there's an inconsistency, and your answer is basically, well, Rabbi said this, so shut up and don't question it, to me, seems to be a bit insufficient. Here's another one, and this, if you've gone to the halachic process class, you'll recognize this as one of my comical inconsistencies. Well, not mine, but what I call a comical inconsistency. Regarding prohibition on swimming, that the Talmud says that if you're not allowed to go swimming because in the event you would drown, you would pull off something and make yourself a life preserver. So on page 1191, here's what Ribiat says in the book. The prohibition on swimming in a river or a pond extends to all situations. That is to say, even where there is little or no likelihood that this could lead to any types of repairs. In parentheses, rabbinic ordinances are generally categorical, i.e. applying even in times and conditions where the original considerations and reasons for the ordinance do not exist. Therefore, swimming is forbidden even in modern times when the early day life preserver is no longer ever used. Very straightforward. When the Talmud says something is prohibited and gives a reason for it, if the reason no longer applies, the law still applies. Except, turning back to page 1160, he writes regarding dancing on Simchas Torah, singing and dancing on Shabbat. He says here, singing is not included under any rabbinic restriction. However, dancing and clapping in tune with singing is prohibited, as is the use of musical instruments, because these activities are frequently accompanied with music and could ultimately lead to repairing an instrument. Even so, many poskim rule that clapping in rhythm with the singing is permitted today because, unlike earlier days, the average person is not skilled at repairing a musical instrument. Therefore, this rabbinic decree restricting instruments did not extend to clapping and the like. Based on this view, many people permit themselves to clap and drum their fingers while singing on Shabbat. And with Simchat Torah, it is customary to dance on Simchat Torah despite the general ban imposed against dancing on Shabbat and Yom Tov. There is a special exemption on Simchat Torah in deference to the honor of the Torah that is being celebrated at this time. In plain English, in certain cases, we're going to hold by rabbinic law even when the times change, and in other instances, we don't. And that is a methodological halachic issue where, in fact, when you check the footnotes, he selectively cites people. Now, it's not that he's pulling all this stuff out of the blue. He didn't make this up. He's quoting people. But he's quoting sources inconsistently as it suits what he thinks the law ought to be based on his own tradition. That's why we're not studying out of this book. It's a very useful reference for a lot of things. And it could give you some examples. But it's why I will not trust this as a matter of psak. There is a children's book, which I would trust better than this, called The 39 Malachos. And it sounds funny, but it's not really a joke. It's a large picture book that gives you nice little diagrams about things you can do and things that you can't do. And, yeah.
Today, we still hold that you're not allowed to swim or take showers, but it's because of schita, right?
No, not entirely. Because there are ways of getting around schita, too. Just, like, don't dry yourself off. Like, yeah. Don't get involved in that. Uh-huh. You could avoid that. So there are other reasons behind it.
But we still hold that it's...
Well, define we. Meaning, and the why. People will still say you shouldn't go swimming on Shabbat, but in terms of saying what is the exact prohibition, there's a prohibition against squeezing, which we'll get to at some point. Yeah. But you can go swimming without squeezing. It's possible, right? So how do you say that the actual act of swimming is problematic? In terms of the text that we will be using, this is the Mishneh Torah. This was written by Maimonides. This was the first topically organized compilation or codification of Jewish law, where you had, you know, the Rif try to summarize the Talmud in the conclusions of the Talmud. It was organized by the tractates of the Talmud. The Talmud, however, goes all over the place. Maimonides organized it by topic, which makes it much more accessible. The specific book that we're using is this set that is published by Mosnayim Press and translated by a guy named Rabbi Eliyahu Tuger. This is a phenomenal translation, in my opinion. It is accessible, as accurate as you're going to find, and very usefully annotated. So it's got some footnotes behind it that can give you some sources or some greater explanation. For an introduction to Jewish law, this is a place where I would send most people. With the disclaimer that on pretty much anything in Jewish law that you hear from someone, someone is going to disagree. We're not trying to be comprehensive. That's going to be impossible. this is for people who might not have that much of a background to have some starting point, right? And I have to stress that because there's a lot of confirmation bias that comes up when people first start learning Jewish stuff, where you learn things from a rabbi first, then you hear another rabbi say something contradictory, and people like get very confused. Well, my rabbi taught me that, but here I'm learning this, and they don't go along. The answer is rabbis don't agree on anything. So take this as you wish. This class isn't intended as a matter of psak, practical application for Jewish law, as much as teaching the basics of the laws of Shabbat, and each case is really going to have to be handled on its own time. As an aside, I would recommend, if anyone is interested, to pick up the individual volumes. The entire set of this Muznayim thing can get very expensive. And since most people aren't going to be reading or spending a lot of time studying parts involving laws of damages, court cases, how the temple worked, if you're interested in that, by all means, pick it up. You'll save a lot of money, though, if you only get the books of things that you're actually going to use and read. And as much as a book geek that I am, I like it much better if people buy books that they use as opposed to just having stuff on the shelf. All right? Yeah.
This is English and Hebrew?
Yes, I will be passing around the photocopies. That's why I said it's a very good translation. So I'll pass these around. Pause for one. That is a great question there. Did Rambam go to lecture lengths to make the Hebrew accessible? And the answer is absolutely yes. In the introduction to the Mishneh Torah, which we spoke about in the halachic process class, the intent of the Rambam was to, in a way, democratize Jewish law. Many people were not fluent in the Talmud or the reasoning. What Rambam did was he distilled the law, but he wrote it in such a way that it was in relatively basic Hebrew, took out a lot of the Aramaic, and such that the average layperson could pick it up and read it and know what to do. Every now and again, he would use the language that was used in the Talmud, such that if you knew what he was referring to, you could go back to it. One complaint that people have of Maimonides is that he didn't cite his sources. But you also have to consider that, one, not only was footnoting not exactly common in those days, but the actual pagination of the Talmud wasn't set. So the best he could do is like, well, this is in tractate this, this is in tractate that, which would certainly be a little more helpful. But, you know, we'll let that aside. Also, there are certain things that are a matter of interpretation. And we even mentioned in the previous class about the halachic process how you could follow Maimonides' legal methodology but reach a different conclusion. All right? We're not going to get too much in the detail about people disputing with Maimonides. Again, the point is to start off someplace with the laws of Shabbat in a way that we're not going to get too overwhelmed. And another, one final reason about why I think the Rambam is preferable here is the way Rambam usually writes, he will begin with the general and then get a little more specific as you go on. So we might skip if it gets too specific for our purposes. But pedagogically, I think it makes a lot more sense to teach this, as opposed to, say, the Shulchan Aruch, which is another very highly regarded source of Jewish law. When he teaches, or I shouldn't say teach, when he writes the laws of Shabbat, he doesn't do it in terms of general concepts. He does it in terms of chronology. Here's what you do on Friday. Here's how you prepare for Shabbat. But you don't even know the basics of the law. Like, in order to follow the Shulchan Aruch well, you have to already know a lot about Jewish law in order to really appreciate what's going on. All right? So, Sam, please start us off. Oh, yeah, technically, we go around, we ask people to read, usually in the English, we'll refer back to the Hebrew as necessary. If at any point you don't want to read, just say pass and we move on. And if you have any questions, just let us know. So, Sam, start us off.
Resting from labor on the seventh day fulfills a positive commandment, as Exodus 23:12 states, and you shall rest on the seventh day. Anyone who performs a labor on this day negates the observance of a positive commandment and also transgresses a negative commandment. 4, Ibid 2010,
yeah,
states, do not perform any labor on it.
Okay, so starting off with the absolute basic, right? We're not going to get into spiritual details about how important Shabbos is for the Jewish people. You'll find a lot of books on that. Just assume right now it's really important. All right, get the other stuff later or elsewhere. Rambam starts off very purely legally. Laws of Shabbat include two major laws. One, a positive commandment to rest, and a negative commandment not to do milacha, which means work. Something that's very important to mention now is that when it says work here, this has led to some confusion, especially in later days, about what does milacha mean. Milacha, as we're going to see, is a specific category of work that applies to Shabbat. It doesn't mean necessarily that, you know, you can't do anything that might be tiresome. If that were the case, you would never be able to employ a rabbi. Rabbis work a lot on Shabbat, some more than others. That's technically work. We may discuss a bit about how, you know, get certain things done there, but it's not like, well, you know, it's relaxing for me to do a whole bunch of things. It's relaxing for me to, say, go camping and sit by a fire that I just made, right? It's not your personal subjective definition of what is exertion and what is relaxation, right? There are specific halachic legal categories behind this, all right? So we got one positive, one negative. Continue.
What are the liabilities incurred by a person who performs labor on this day? If he does so willingly, as a conscious act of defiance, he is liable for karet. Mm-hmm. If witnesses who administer a warning are present, he should be stoned to death. If he performs labor without being conscious of the transgression, he is liable to bring a sin offering of a fixed nature.
So this sets up, you know, again, very basic introduction. What happens if you don't keep Shabbat? All right, so one is karet, which is a punishment that we saw in one of our, I think, politics of exclusion class. There's a lot of back, you know, when I give references to class, if you weren't here for that, it's okay. But for the ones who are here, it's nice reinforcement. That is a spiritual cutting off, literally what it means. Refers to either dying young or dying without children, considered a fairly severe penalty. If you have witnesses and warning, which Maimonides will talk about in Laws of Testimony and Punishments and all that, this is a capital offense. Meaning, if you don't keep Shabbat and you have witnesses and they warn you, if you do this, you're going to be stoned to death and you do it anyway, it can be a capital offense. This actually, Rambam's explanation explains why in the Torah you find both punishments. We're violating Shabbat once the Torah, one time the Torah says mot you mot you die, and another time it says nikta nefeshahi, right, you get cut off from the people. So how could it be both? One is with witnesses and one is without. And if you sin by accident, or as it puts here, without being conscious of the transgression, then you bring a certain sacrifice. Because that's what you do when you sin unintentionally. We call it shkaga. You did something, again, not at the, in terms of transgressions of Jewish law, intent matters. Yeah.
Without being conscious of the transgression, how are you going to know to bring...
There are differences of that. There's a whole section about shkaga, exactly like what counters that. In terms of either ignorance, and people will discuss things whether or not it means ignorance of the law, or you know the law and you didn't realize that by doing something, you're doing something else. The point being, you did not intend to violate the Shabbat. Let's just leave it at that without getting into the details. All right? There are ways you can violate Shabbat without intending to.
Sure.
Right? And I'm not going to get into the psak halacha of what counts as a shkaga, but again, for two examples is, one, you don't know that something is actually prohibited. And maybe if you knew it was prohibited, you wouldn't have done it. Another one is, you knew something was prohibited, but you didn't realize that you were doing that in the action that you were doing. All right? Like, oh, I didn't realize that was a problem. Okay? Again, intro. He gets into details later on. All right? Karin, take number two. This is a very important halakha. The way that Rambam is divided, it's chapter, and then each subunit is called a halakha. All right? So this is halakha bet in chapter one.
Whenever the expression, the one who performs this is liable, is used within the context of the Sabbath laws, the intent is that he is liable for karet, and if witnesses are present and administer a warning, he is liable to be stoned to death. If he performs such an activity without being aware of the transgression, he is liable for a sin offering.
Okay. So the first thing is, he is explaining in these next, this one, and in three and four, the terms used to distinguish different types of prohibitions or violations on Shabbat. The first one is the use of the word chayav. When the word chayav is used, it is meant to refer to a biblical prohibition, meaning you have violated Shabbat on the biblical nature such that if you did it intentionally, you get the punishment of karet, and if you had warning, then you get the punishment of mitah. The most severe one is used for chayav. Dana, take the next one.
Whenever the expression "one who performs this is not liable" is used, the intent is that he is not liable for kares, for execution by stoning, or for bringing a sin offering. It is, however, forbidden to perform this act on the Sabbath. In such an instance, the prohibition is rabbinic in origin and was instituted as a safeguard against the performance of labor. A person who performs such an act is given stripes for defiance.
Lashes, yes. Yeah. From Akat Mardut. So, there's a second category that applies to the laws of Shabbat called patur, which literally means exempt. He says not liable. When that word patur is used, you think, well, oh, you're all fine. Not exactly. Patur refers to things that you are exempt from biblical violation, but you're violating rabbinic law. To explain how this works, certain laws, one way of organizing Jewish law is biblical and rabbinic. Biblical, as you could probably guess, are based straight out of the Bible, either through an explicit verse or a rabbinic legal exposition of what the verse means. For example, we're told not to do melacha, don't do work on Shabbat. But what counts as work, that's defined by the sages. I mean, there's one. Anyone know which one melacha is mentioned in the Torah? Which one category of work is mentioned explicitly?
Not making fire?
Yeah, you got the winner here, fire. Right? Now, as you remember from that book, there are 39 types of categories for it, but only fire is mentioned. The rabbis, through their tradition, say, well, actually, in addition to fire, there are 38 other categories. Right? So those would be biblical. But there are also rabbinic enactments, and we're going to go through some of the general details, where even though you haven't violated biblical law, rabbis still said not to do it. Usually, common reason for it is something called a sayag l'Torah, a fence around the Torah. If something is close enough to violate biblical law, the rabbis will make certain enactments to say, well, don't even do this, usually lest you come to violate something else. Usually. Not always the case, but that's one way of understanding rabbinic decrees. And the punishment for these is makat mardut. He calls here stripes for defiance. There are two different types of corporal punishment, not capital punishment, corporal where we physically beat you. One is the makot mentioned in the Torah for if you violate a negative prohibition, where the Torah says don't do something, and you do it, then you get certain types of lashes. But you can also get lashed by the sages for ignoring their words. They say, well, and basically they can beat you into compliance. We discuss a little bit about that in some of our other classes too, exactly how and when does a court have the authority. Spoiler, no one today has the authority to actually do that. People think they do, but as some of our friends up north have found, you are subject to arrest and investigation by the FBI. So we don't do that anymore. So, something that is chayav is violating Shabbat on a biblical level. Something that is patur, you're violating Shabbat on a rabbinic level. Shulamis, take the next one, number four.
Whenever the expression, it is permissible to do this, is used, the intent is that at the outset, one may perform this act. Similarly, whenever the expression, one is under no obligation or one is not liable at all, are used, one does not receive any punishment at all.
So the last category is that which is either called mutar, permissible, or patur mikolam, or you're exempt from everything. These are things, simply put, that you're allowed to do on Shabbat. All right, so you've got your three categories: biblical, rabbinic, and completely permitted. You may ask legitimately, well, what's the difference? Like, why should we care about a distinction between rabbinic and biblical prohibition, especially if you don't like you're still not supposed to do them? From a matter of psak, of applying Jewish law, this is essential. Things that are biblical are much more strict and much more severe. Things that are rabbinic, you have a little bit more latitude and leeway, in particular if there are emergencies that come up. All right? And it's important to know these distinctions, especially when you start getting to specific cases. Yeah?
Why do they spell the mutar? Why isn't it just anything that's not in the first two categories?
Because he's explaining the terms that he's going to use. The way that a lot of the Jewish law is going to work is they'll say, give a case and say, if someone does this, chayav. If someone does that, patur. Someone who does this, mutar. And that is a way of, he's telling you the idioms that he's using to express certain laws.
Like
so if he says, yeah, exactly, it's a shorthand. So if someone says, whoever does this patur, that's his way of telling you, you haven't violated Shabbat biblically, but you violated it rabbinically. That's all he's using here. He's setting up the definitions. It's almost like putting the glossary at the very beginning so you understand what he's talking about through the duration of the laws of Shabbat. Yeah.
We said earlier that the one prohibition that's mentioned in the Torah is lighting a fire.
The one melacha, not prohibition. Because you could say melacha was the prohibition,
yeah.
But the one specific act was lighting a fire.
Okay, so when they found the guy, Mekoshe Shetzim, and they stoned him.
Mm. And they were, if you might recall, they didn't know what to do with him initially.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So is that a malacha, for starters?
We'll get down there. Listen, again,
yeah.
Asking specific questions at this point is very premature.
Okay.
Rambam gets through a whole lot of details here. I mean,
yeah.
We're only in the beginning, chapter one,
yeah.
You know, first few things. This is as general as you get.
Okay.
What you may find even later on is Rambam will even begin a chapter talking about a specific topic, and there too will begin here general rules and then get more specific. It's also why you should be careful before you say Rambam is contradicting himself, because is he getting more specific from what he said at the outset, or is he actually saying two completely mutually contradictory things? Yeah.
When they stoned the person who made the fire on Shabbat.
First off, he didn't make a fire on Shabbat. He gathered twigs on Shabbat. And two, we're not talking about that yet. Again, we're trying to keep things in order here. Rambam is, you know, wrote this intelligibly, right? So we're going to get through as much as we can. This, incidentally, is only volume one. In the translation, there are two volumes of this. There's a lot of stuff in the laws of Shabbat, which is why we're doing this and why we're going to do this slowly. It's just going to take some time and take some patience. You're not going to get everything at once, but it's worth it when you go through it slowly, because then you'll actually understand what everything is built off of. And when you read other halacha books, you may have a greater sense of where are they getting this from, and maybe points of departure from Rambam, which again is going to happen frequently. So don't get unnerved if someone tells you something that contradicts. These three distinctions are almost, I would say, general. And that if you read a halacha book in Hebrew that makes this distinction, it's pretty much always going to be the same. All right? Tibia, can you read number five?
Yeah. It is permissible to perform an act that is permitted on the Shabbat. The fact that it's possible, but is one not to absolute certainty that is a result of one's action. A forbidden labor will be performed, provided one does not have the intent to perform that labor.
Turn the page.
The minimum measure of...
No, what is implied?
Oh.
Yeah, sorry about that. It's double-sided.
I just put the...
Got it. Okay.
What is implied? A person may drag a bed, chair, bench, and like on the ground on the Sabbath, provided he does not intend to gouge out the groove of the earth while dragging them. Therefore, if he did not gouge out and groove the... in the ground while digging them, as if no consequences that he would do this intent in mind. Similarly, a person may tread on the grass on a Shabbat as long as his intent is not to uproot it. Thus, he should uproot that is no consequence. Also, a person
should it be uprooted that is of no consequence.
As a person may rub powdered herbs and like over his hands, provided he does not intend to remove his hair. Therefore, if the hair is removed, there is no consequence. Based on the same rationale, one may not enter the narrow opening on Shabbat. Even though while doing so, one causes pieces of the wall to fall, similarly permissible for the performing act with similar repercussions, provided that one does not have intent of doing so.
Okay. This, in Hebrew, is called Davar She'eino Mitkaven. Something to which you did not have intention. This is a case where you are doing something which is permissible. Okay? And through the act of permissibility, you may or may not violate a Jewish law. So he gives an example. If you're dragging a couch, like across your... here's a scenario. You live out in suburbia. You got a nice fenced-in backyard, all right? So you got no problem of carrying. And you got guests over, and you got lawn chairs. You want to move your lawn chair from one part of your lawn to another part of your lawn. Is it forbidden to move a lawn chair within your fenced-in area attached to your house? No. Now, it's possible that during the course of you dragging the chair, you may or may not uproot some things of grass. Right? As long as it's not absolute certain that you're going to uproot those things of grass, and you didn't intend to uproot the grass, you're fine. The other example he gives, walking, let's say, on a muddy field, right? Or a muddy grass thing. Some women here wear heels, right? Men sometimes wear heels on their shoes, so not nearly as high, right? But when you step down in that grass, you're sort of creating like a little burrow or like doing things that otherwise might be considered an act of gardening. Now, when I walk across like a muddy field, I'm really not intending to like make any grooves in the, in the ground. Might I do it? Might I not do it? Well, there's really no way to tell if your actions will definitively do stuff or not. But at the very least, like, I don't want this to happen. I'm not sure it's going to happen. Therefore, it's permissible, right? And this is something, an act that is actually permissible. You want to take the next one? This is number six.
In contrast, when one performs a deed that results in the performance of a forbidden labor, and it is a certainty that this deed will cause that labor to be performed, one is liable, even though one did not intend to perform the forbidden labor. What is implied? A person needs a fowl's head to serve as a toy for a child, and therefore cuts off the fowl's head on the Sabbath. Although his ultimate purpose is not merely to slaughter the chicken, he is liable. It is obvious that it is impossible for the head of a living being to be cut off and for that being to survive. Instead, the fowl's death came about because of this activity. Therefore, he is liable. The same applies in other similar situations.
Does anyone know what this is called in Aramaic? This is a psik resha. This is actually, he's not citing, this is actually a typology here. A psik resha delo nichale. It's called you're cutting off the head. And it's short for you're cutting off the head of a chicken because you want to play with the chicken's head. You didn't want to kill it, right? But has anyone cut off the head of a chicken and found the chicken to live? Zombie chickens? No. All right. So because the act of cutting off a head of a chicken means that it is inevitable that your action caused the chicken to die, that is forbidden on Shabbat, even though you can argue you did not intend for the chicken to die. That act of inevitable consequence is what a psik resha is, regardless of what happened, or regardless of what intent you have. Right? Inevitable consequence is bad. If the consequence was not inevitable, meaning it could go either way, well then that would be okay. Because otherwise you're saying, I mean, you could almost say ein ledavar sof. Well, I, you know, only, let's find a good example. I only like decided to, well, forget about a sinner. You could figure stuff out on your own. Anyway, just remember, the typology here is a psik resha, which is Aramaic for cutting off the head. All right? And that refers to an inevitable consequence is forbidden. Because if by your action you know this is going to happen, you're not allowed to do that. Even if you didn't intend it for it to happen, you know with certainty that it will. Once you have that degree of certainty, not allowed to do it. Okay?
It's just an American law.
Explain.
If you know that what you do is going to result in an injury to somebody, you are liable.
You're liable also with other accidents, too. But, yeah, I mean, that's also...
You know that your action has to result in an injury or some loss on that person. You're not permitted to do it.
You had a question?
Just as a side.
Sure.
Was a chicken's head a common toy?
Not that I know of. No, that is a great case. So when the Talmud gives some of these examples, I don't know how much was actually this is what happened enough that you use that versus this was the best legal explanation for what's describing what's going on here. In a lot of discussions of law, people come up with a hypothetical scenario and say, what would the law be in such and such a case? The Talmud operates like that a lot. So I don't know how common it was, but it was a good enough example that starkly demonstrated when you cut off the head of a chicken, it's going to die. Right? Now, were chickens' heads popular toys? I don't know. I have no idea how you would even go about finding that. But no. Good question, though. Take the next one,
okay.
Seven.
Anyone who performs a forbidden labor, even if he has no need for the actual labor he performed, is liable for his deed.
Now again, this is chayav. So it's if you're doing an act, a forbidden act in Shabbat of Melacha, even though you did not need the act itself, or the labor, then you're still liable. And he gives an example.
What is implied? A person extinguished a lamp because he needed to save the oil or the wick from being destroyed or from burning, or so that the earthenware reservoir of the lamp that holds the oil would not break. Since he had the intent of extinguishing the lamp, even though he did not do so for the usual purpose of extinguishing, but merely for the sake of the oil, the wick, or the earthenware, he is liable.
So remember we said before that intent matters. So now we're, you know, sort of refining that definition of what does intent mean. So one, if the action that you're doing was inevitable, it doesn't matter what your intent was, that's still a problem. Two, as long as you had the intent to do the action, but the reasons you had for it might be unusual. Normally you would say, I'm extinguishing the fire because I want it to be dark. That's the normal reason why people extinguish fires. But here there are a whole bunch of other reasons why you want to extinguish a fire that aren't directly related to the extinguishing. It's like, oh, if it burns all the way down, it'll break my pot, right? So that, you know, you even though your intention might be not quite the norm, since you still have the intention to do the act, it's problematic. Okay? Side note here, there's... whatever. Forget the side notes. I know this gets confusing. Continue the last... continue?
Similarly, a person who moves a thorn 4 cubits in the public domain or extinguishes a coal so that many people will not be injured by it is liable. Although the usual purpose served by extinguishing the coal or moving the thorn is not important to him, and his intent was merely to prevent injury, he is liable. The same applies in other similar situations.
So even if your intent was for the common good, since you had carrying, and we'll get to that later, certain amounts is prohibited on Shabbat through certain domains, again, greater detail. Even if carrying, you're doing it to serve a public need, since your intent was still to carry, that is chayav. You have violated Shabbat biblically. Your intention is, right, on the high level, no good. You had a question.
What if the earthenware lamp is in danger of breaking and then causing...
We're not... skipping all details there, right? We'll get there at some point later in terms of other instances. So, go to number 8.
Whenever a person intends to perform a forbidden labor, but instead, through his actions, causes the performance of another forbidden labor for which he had no intent, he is not liable. Because his intent was not carried out.
So stop here. Now here, the Rambam uses the idiom patur, right? So it's not you're exempt. You haven't violated Shabbat biblically. In order to violate Shabbat biblically, you need full intention, but you need to have full intention to violate the prohibition that you actually had in mind. So here's the example. Go ahead.
What is implied? A person threw a stone or shot an arrow at a colleague or at an animal with the intent of slaying them. Should the object that he propelled uproot a tree or in its progress and not kill the intended victim, he is free of liability.
Meaning, again, it's rabbinically prohibited. Explain that in plain English. I wanted to kill someone, right? I didn't kill someone, but instead I uprooted a tree. I've got bad aim, all right? And now, how an arrow would uproot... Ignore physics about how an arrow uproots a tree, all right? The point being... Since I intended to kill someone, but I didn't intend to uproot a tree, assuming I didn't actually kill someone, I haven't violated Shabbat biblically. Because my intention was to do one prohibition, but I did another instead. So that already does not count as proper intention. You have to intend to do the act that you actually did. If you have intention to do a different act than the one you actually did, that is not enough intention for you to violate Shabbat on a biblical level. Knocks it down to a rabbinic one. Yeah.
Isn't murder against Shabbat as well?
Yes. You're not allowed to kill people on Shabbat. This is assuming you haven't actually killed the person.
Right.
If you did kill the person, you'd be in bigger trouble
too.
Don't
you have the intent to kill?
Yes, but the intent, again, to quote Sideshow Bob from The Simpsons, I was put in jail for a crime I didn't commit. Attempted murder. What is that? Really? Did they give the Nobel Prize for attempted chemistry, right? So there's no prohibition against attempted murder. I mean, if you actually damaged someone, you'd be held liable, right? But like if I shot at someone and missed completely, Although we did have a nice joke with that after Obama won the Peace Prize of getting, like, the Nobel Prize for attempted peace. But that was a side thing. For anyone who was fans of Simpsons, found that amusing.
But if intent...
I get to quote Sideshow Bob. I love this class.
But if it's...
Yeah, let me continue.
If intent matters...
Yeah.
When you're violating Shabbat.
Yes.
Why shouldn't it matter when you attempt to violate Shabbat?
Because we judge you based on the actions. It's a combination of what is your intention and what is your action, right? You need the combination of the two. Like when you extinguish a candle, you move something for other reasons. Your intention is to move, let's say, the thorn example. You're moving a thorn from the public domain. You intend to move it, and you actually do move it. Right? That's biblical prohibition. If I intend to move, let's say, a tree, to uproot a tree, but because I'm incredibly weak, I can't, then I haven't done anything. Right? So you're not judged based purely. You need the combination of your intention and your action. If you don't do the action, you can't be held liable for that action.
So if you're an incompetent assassin, you're
yes.
going to get away with it. And if you're
well, it's not that you—it's not that you're getting away with murder. It's you haven't committed murder because you're incompetent.
Well, your intent was to commit the murder.
But then you're still not guilty of murder because you haven't actually done it. If I intended and then I killed someone, that's a problem. Or if I intended to kill one person and then killed someone, we'll worry about murder in a separate case here. But at least focusing on Shabbat, if you intended to do what, or even if you take out the murder example here, he says here, how much more so does this principle apply if one had the intent of performing a lesser transgression and one performed a more serious one? For example, if you intended to throw a stone into a Carmelite and instead passed into a public domain, he is not held liable. To explain that, in the laws of carrying, we saw this in the class of Erevin that we did in Wednesdays recently, there are four domains. The Carmelite is an area where it is forbidden rabbinically to carry. From a private domain to this place called Carmelite is a rabbinic prohibition. From a Carmelite to a public domain is a biblical violation. So let's take that. Let's take murder out if that, you know, might get too confusing. So think about it this way. I'm borrowing your cup for a second. This cup is biblical. This cup is rabbinic. Right? Now, I wanted to throw into the rabbinic domain. I, however, have absolutely horrible aim, and I wind up throwing it over here. So, did I violate biblical Shabbat? No. I intended to violate this prohibition, not that prohibition, and vice versa. Right? So, then your intent does matter. Right? Because if the intent is not lined up with it, now if I intended to throw in the public domain, and I threw it in the public domain, that's a problem. Right? Let me rephrase that. That's a biblical problem. But if I intended to throw here and I accidentally threw over here, that's a rabbinic problem. Make sense? A little more sense than murder?
It makes sense.
Okay.
It just begs the question as how do you determine intent?
That is a wonderful question. We'll have to table that for now. We'll go around. We have a few different questions here. So we'll go around. So hold on to your questions. We'll go around the table.
So it says, I think, anyone who performs the forbidden labor. So in the murder example, let's say you shoot a gun, the bullet goes through the person. So you actually kill the person, and then the tree falls over.
So that's a great question. That is comes under a category of kamle midarabamine, which means in English, if through one action you violate multiple prohibitions or you're liable for multiple things, we only charge you with the highest count. Here's an example. If I shoot someone in the heart, I'm also tearing their shirt. Right? So in theory, I owe them money for the shirt. Right? But no, you don't say that. It's like, I killed you, or I killed a person, so I'm liable for the death penalty. You don't say, oh yeah, by the way, you also owe money for the shirt. Right? So in this particular event where you killed someone, right, it doesn't really matter what else happened. You're liable for murder, like, that's it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Never mind.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Okay. Dana?
We don't actually hold like this, do we?
I'm not dealing with... In terms of what Kavana is?
No, in terms of if you intended to commit one act and you committed another.
For sure. Well, it's hard to say about do we hold this way, simply because, again, not only will you probably have a lot of arguments, but we don't have enforcement. Because we don't have enforcement, it's all like God's the one who's keeping the score. I can't, right? Additionally, there's no way to really prove like one way or the other in this because you had that great question, how do you determine intent? Usually it's a matter of revealing intent or there's something that someone does that is megaledaat, that reveals your real intention behind it. At the end of the day, since we don't have a mechanism for enforcing the laws of Shabbat, this is an irrelevant question, right? Huh? It's not irrelevant in terms of making psak halacha. I'll give you another example. This comes up a bit with the Tzomet Institute. Has anyone here heard of the Tzomet Institute? They're based out of Alon Shavuot, as I recall, and one of the things they're most known for is constructing elaborate electronic devices for use on Shabbat.
Oh, yeah.
That involve weird types of circuitry. Well, interesting types of circuitry that actually takes into account matters of intention and second and third degree actions. So you can say that that's a little bit more of an applied thing. We're not going to get into the technical circuitry. I'm sure they have a website. If you really want to, you can look up a whole bunch of research that they have on that. But people do rely on intention for matters of practical psak halacha. Is it exactly the formulation of Rambam? I could actually give you one example of someone who doesn't agree with what Rambam says. The Ba'alei Tosafot have a very different vision, or at least in one thing of Ba'alei Tosafot, have a very different understanding of what intention has to be. And it was based on that the conservative movement permitted driving to shul on Shabbat. Or at least one of the responses did. So it does get complicated. Again, basic introduction here. Main thing, intent matters. All right? And concludes here. Yeah, you had a question.
It's just that, again, he's just taking extreme cases to make a point about Matsriya or intention.
Yes. Yeah. That's exactly what he's doing. Because, again, he's starting off trying to explain the concepts of what does it mean to violate Shabbat. It's not just that you do something. You have to know what you're doing. All right, and he says, should a person have the intent to perform a committed act instead of another act which is forbidden, he is not held liable. For example, should he intend to cut produce that was not attached to the ground instead cut produce that was attached to the ground, he is not held liable. And here he says, inochayav plum, right? It says, that he's not obligated in anything. And the same is true in other situations here. So this is a certain type of accident. Dana, you mentioned about how do you violate Shabbat without being intended, right? If you thought something was outright permitted according to Rambam here, and this is when you know the law. So let's say, you have, let's give an example, a tomato, right? You thought a tomato wasn't attached. You just thought it was lying on the ground. Said, oh, tomato, fell off, I'm going to eat it. And when you take it off, you realize it was attached, right? But not until it was too late, until you already plucked it. According to Rambam, you're not exempt anything. Because you had an intent to do something that was entirely permissible, right? And you did it. It's like, wait, my intention was to pick up a tomato. But my intention was to pick up a tomato that wasn't attached to the ground. Oh, it turns out this one was. And here he says, "Eino chayav klum." You're not exempt anything because your intent was to do something that was entirely permissible, but it turns out that it wasn't. So that's a good example that he offers right here about violating Shabbat without really knowing or intending. Well, you might have realized you violated Shabbat afterwards, but you didn't intend to. Right?
You are exempt.
According to the language of the Rambam here, he says, "Eino chayav klum." You are not obligated in anything, which would seem to imply that you haven't even violated rabbinic law. Right? Let me just check the time. Let's stop here because, we need to find more arbitrary places to stop. So we'll try to keep it at around an hour. We did a lot today. Take some time to digest. All right. If you want, you can take these source sheets back. But if you do take it back, you have to bring it back with you. I can print out some more, copies for next week and the like. So if you want to take it home, fine. If you want to leave it here, that's okay too. All right. Have a wonderful week.